Welcome to Jonathan on Money, the personal finance podcast that brings you the latest insights and strategies to help you achieve your financial goals. I'm your host, Jonathan I. Shankman. On this podcast, we'll cover everything from investing, financial planning, retirement, and behavioral finance. I'll share advice and practical tips to help you make the most of your money. So whether you're just starting out or looking to take your finances to the next level, Jonathan on Money is here to help. Let's dive into this week's show. Welcome to this week's episode of Jonathan on Money. This week, it's episode number 51, and we're still in the middle of tax season. I hope that it's going well for everyone. It's worth noting, if gathering all your various 1099s, K-1s, and other documentation for your investment accounts was cumbersome this year, you may want to consider cleaning up your investment portfolio. There's really no reason gathering your tax documents should take more than 10 minutes. I strongly believe that investors of all ages and levels of wealth should keep their portfolio streamlined. And the first step to doing that is keeping things consolidated and as tax efficient as possible. Naturally, if I can help you in terms of getting things in order, or even if you have a question, feel free to reach out to me and I'm happy to help where I can. Also, a quick reminder, I share daily financial planning videos on YouTube. The name of my channel is Jonathan on Money, so be sure to subscribe so you can view that content. They're only about 2 to 3 minutes long and are generally on something that is quite timely, so be sure to check that out. That's Jonathan on Money on YouTube. Okay, now back to our regularly scheduled program. So my talking points this week will discuss a question I received recently about some personal finance rules of thumb with a firm twist, my thoughts on that. And this should be a fun and informative list to get a better handle on your own financial situation. We're also going to discuss an old adage that is very timely given the recent gyrations of the market. And as always, I'll spend the last few minutes of the episode answering listener questions. Well, with that, let's jump into this week's talking points. So last year, there was a post circulating on social media with a firm individual salary and the breakdown of how it's all spent. It highlighted the percentage of a salary that went to taxes, yeshiva tuition, housing, retirement, vacations, cars, and more. It provided a quick and interesting snapshot into one's personal finances. Naturally, it made others in the firm community wonder how their finances compared. People were wondering, am I spending too much on housing costs? Am I saving enough? Can I afford to retire? These are all questions about which people wonder, but many aren't sure how to answer. While everyone's personal finances and spending patterns are different, there are certain quick rules of thumb that may provide a framework for or a quick assessment of your finances. This week, I've decided to compile some popular rules of thumb to share with listeners and offer my own thoughts on the relevance of each rule. And keep in mind, it's okay if your personal finance situation doesn't align up exactly with every rule. After all, these are, by definition, overly general guidelines. Some of them may not be applicable to your life at all. However, if your circumstances are totally out of whack relative to many of these rules, it may be worth reviewing your finances and hiring a professional to help make the appropriate adjustments. Okay, first is to have 3 to 6 months worth of expense money, your emergency fund. So an emergency fund is a pool of money sitting in cash that is available for expenses. It's one of the cornerstones of financial planning. It's imperative that every person maintain an adequate balance to cover their expenses in case of an emergency, including job loss, illness, or unforeseen expenses. And 3 to 6 months of expense money is a good starting point. Though, depending on personal circumstances, some folks may consider keeping more than that. The next rule of thumb is 50-20-30 rule. A typical budgeting framework states that you should spend up to 50% of your after-tax income on needs and obligations, such as putting food on the table and yeshiva tuition. 20% should be set aside and invested. The remaining 30% should be spent on debt repayment and anything left over on whatever you want. This is a good rule, but it should be modified for the firm community to 50-20-20-10. The new bucket suggests 10% away from the discretionary spending category earmarked for tzedakah. The challenge in the Orthodox Jewish community is that many people don't have the luxury of extra cash flow to spend on other items. Discretionary funds are often needed to afford maintaining a firm lifestyle. However, I think all listeners will agree that there is no better usage of the funds than that. Next rule is limits on housing costs. A person's mortgage, including taxes and insurance, should not exceed 30% of gross monthly income. This is a good rule. If your housing costs are much more expensive, consider moving to a location where the housing prices are cheaper. While moving is never easy, it will likely offload a huge amount of financial pressure and improve your quality of life as well. Automobile rules of thumb. 1. Limit car payments to 10% of your monthly net pay. 2. Keep your total car costs, including gas, insurance, repairs, and maintenance, below 20% of your income. 3. When buying a car, put 20% down and limit the loan to term to 4 years. 4. If repair costs are more than your car's worth, which can be determined by Kelley Blue Book, or exceed 1 year's worth of monthly payments, then replace the car. My view on cars is that they can derail your finances if done wrong. A car's primary function is to get you and your family from point A to point B. It is not a status symbol. Most people should never own or lease a luxury car. Additionally, it is rarely a necessity for one's family to have more than two automobiles. More can be said on each of these points, but if you stick with this framework, you'll probably make the right decision regarding your car. Next one, rule of thumb is total debt. All debt payments, including mortgage, should be less than 36% of monthly gross income. Remember, as a general rule, debt should be avoided. For most people, debt will erode their finances and impede their ability to grow their wealth. Over time, you should work to eliminate all your debts. Next is, when is it appropriate to have credit card debt? Never. Avoid and pay off all credit card debt that you have today. The next is the rule of 10. And this is a helpful framework for large discretionary purchases to reflect on how it will make you feel in 10 days, 10 weeks, and 10 years. Having the proper perspective can help calm buying urges for purchases you will later regret. In the age of Amazon and overnight delivery, taking a breath and rethinking through big purchases is a worthwhile exercise. The next one is 10 minus your age for your portfolio. And I would recommend taking this rule of thumb with a huge grain of salt. The 100 minus your age rule is a benchmark for how to split your investment portfolio across stocks and bonds. Per the rule, you subtract your age from 100 to arrive at the percentage you should invest in stocks, with the balance allocated to bonds. The purpose of this rule is to maintain a balanced portfolio between volatile and growth assets, like which are stocks, and typically more conservative and less volatile assets, like bonds. As one gets older and closer to retirement, they will shift more money into bonds and supposedly take less risk. While theoretically sound, the issue with this rule is in the year assumption. People are living longer than ever, which may necessitate having more stock exposure in one's portfolio, even retirement, in order to outpace inflation. It's realistic to have a 30 or 40 year retirement or even longer. So holding too much in bonds may cause an investor to prematurely exhaust their funds. Furthermore, everybody's situation is different and income sources may vary over time. Therefore, taking a more dynamic and hands-on approach to portfolio construction makes the most sense. Next is the rule of 72, and I like this rule, I use it frequently. This rule allows you to determine approximately how long it will take you to double your money by dividing 72 by your expected annual rate of return. For example, with a 6% annual rate of return, an investment will double in approximately 12 years, 72 divided by 6. This is useful for quick mental math to assess the growth of one's account, assuming no additional contributions. Next is 10 times your gross annual income for life insurance. So this rule is far too general. Practically, the appropriate level of coverage depends on your individual needs. Additionally, your income will likely increase significantly from 25 to 55, which would translate to getting more life insurance according to this rule. However, the exact opposite is often true, with less life insurance needed when you're older. I found it to be more helpful to approximate your needs and expenses based on lifestyle and choices. Purchasing a relatively cheap 30-year term policy based on your anticipated needs, even while you're young and have a modest income, can help protect your family for decades in the future. Additionally, life insurance can be added if necessary down the road. The next rule of thumb is saving 15% of income for retirement. This rule doesn't exactly jive with a previous point on budgeting. However, if you can save and invest 15% of your income every year for your entire 40 to 50 year career and do so in a tax advantage retirement account, you should be quite financially comfortable by the time you retire. The next one is replacing about 70% of your pre-retirement income in retirement. Folks planning for retirement often ask me how much income they'll need to maintain their lifestyle in retirement. The answer is not always simple. Certain expenses like tuition, raising kids, and housing costs will hopefully be less. Other expenses will eventually increase, like healthcare or long-term care. However, for planning purposes, assuming you'll need 70% of your pre-retirement income may be a good starting point. The next one is a 4% safe withdrawal rate. A question I often receive from clients is how much they can pull from their retirement accounts without running out of their funds. That's when the 4% withdrawal rate comes into play. If your portfolio is structured appropriately, you may be able to safely withdraw 4% of the money in your portfolio every year without exhausting your funds. Please note there are many, many factors that come into play when determining a truly safe withdrawal rate. 4% is merely a helpful framework to think about spending in retirement. And finally, this is the last rule of thumb here. When can I retire? And not a week goes by where I don't get this question. A quick and simple rule of thumb is that you should be able to comfortably retire when your savings are at least 25 times your annual expenses. Obviously, this depends on your age, expenses, and other sources of income, but this is a minimum benchmark for which to strive. The good thing about rules of thumb is that they allow for quick assessments to ensure that you're on track to achieve your financial objectives. Hopefully, these talking points will provide you with either a peace of mind or reveal flaws in your current strategy. Either way, you should now have some clarity on general guidelines on how to proceed going forward. Okay, those are the talking points this week. And as a reminder, you can be notified of all my recent articles, webinars, and all the work I put out by subscribing to my free monthly newsletter at parkbridgewealth.com/newsletter. We're currently at 8,500 subscribers and growing. So feel free to sign up and invite friends as well. Now it's time for this week's money quote, which is an old proverb, which is not attributed to anybody specific. And it states, in bear markets, stocks return to their rightful owners. This is timely because as of this recording, the market dropped this past week. And it's amazing to me that despite the bounce back in stocks in 2023 and the run up in the market in the first quarter of this year, some investors still feel the urge to sell when there is a slight speed bump with market volatility. This brings up the important concept of loss aversion, which was introduced by Daniel Kahneman. I mentioned him last week, the legendary psychologist who pioneered the world of behavioral finance. He explained that loss aversion is the concept that a monetary loss feels much worse than a gain. And I see this in my practice all the time where I won't hear anything from clients and the markets go up. However, when the market drops, many investors want to sell everything. This brings me back to the quote. If you do not have the temperament and self-control to see your portfolio drop on occasion, then you may not be fit to be a stock market investor. Folks are fit to be stock investors are those who realize that a drop in the market is normal, and instead of panicking, they buy more stocks from the people who shouldn't be in the market in the first place, and they sell everything. One of the most important factors with investing is not to let your emotions influence your decisions when the market's gyrating in value. If you can do that, you will be successful. Okay, now let's jump into this week's financial questions. And if you do have a question, feel free to submit it to me at jonathan@parkbridgewealth.com. And it may be answered in a future episode. Okay, first question. My brother is an experienced investor, and he told me recently that I'm a rookie investor. I'm in my mid-30s and have been doing well over the past few years. I asked him to tell me what makes me a rookie investor, and he walked away and didn't answer me. My question is, what makes someone a rookie investor? So it sounds like, first of all, it sounds like you and your bro have a healthy relationship. And I'm not sure what he meant, but some things that come to my mind when I think about investors who are inexperienced are as follows. And I'll name, I don't know, like about 11 of them. The first one is those who are focused on fees at the expense of everything else. Two, shopping around for someone who claims to be able to offer the best performance. Remember, you're buying into a pipe dream when someone says that, not a practical plan to grow your wealth. Three, folks who assume that buying an index fund is sufficient to achieve all your financial planning goals. An index fund is not a plan or a process. Four, assuming real estate only goes up in value. Newsflash, it doesn't. Five, someone who thinks renting is throwing away money. Renting gives you a place to live without the headache of home ownership. It is also a prudent strategy for many families. Six, people who think they will be able to outperform the S&P 500 over the long term, they won't. And it shouldn't be your goal in the first place. Seven, anyone who believes that they have access to something special because they are a high net worth investor. The investment landscape has been democratized, so most investors can access the best investments. Don't be suckered into investing in something because it sounds exclusive, and rich people do not like when I tell them that, but it's a fact of life. 8, sitting in cash until the market settles down. What is the definition of settling down? Anyway, the reality is that the market will always gyrate up and down, and while you're waiting for an unspecified sign from Hashem to enter the market, you're losing buying power by hiding in cash. 9, someone who's concerned with every negative news headline and how it will impact their portfolio. The world is a big place, and plenty of not nice things happen on a regular basis. Furthermore, cable news is in the business of reminding everyone that bad things happen. 99.9% of these bad things will not impact your portfolio, so stop worrying about it. 10, people who think the world is coming to an end and they should move to cash. If these people are really serious and believe that the world is coming to an end, they would buy land in South Dakota and buy a few years of supplies of canned goods, water, and ammo. They don't do this because they know the world won't come to an end. They need to calm down and just stay the course. And 11, people that check their accounts incessantly. This may be hard for many newbie investors to comprehend, but believe it or not, checking your account more frequently would not help boost your performance numbers. I can keep going on and on, but I want to get other questions. However, what I will say is, if you relate to any of these things, you are probably a rookie investor. Next question, what advice would you give to someone in their 30s? And I could probably give a bunch of advice. However, I'll boil it down to only a few items. 1, make sure you're out of debt by your early 30s. You don't want a debt hanging over your head as you enter middle age. 2, don't try to keep up with the Joneses. One's 30s is when people start making decent money because you now have experience and expertise, 2 things that universities don't give you, by the way. There's the temptation to want to spend to keep up with others in your community. You shouldn't do it. The slope is slippery, and once you start, it'll be very hard to tone down your lifestyle. Live within your means and don't worry about what everyone else is doing. 3, make sure you have relevant insurance. By one's 30s, many people will have a family and people who rely on their income. Make sure you are adequately insured in case you can't work. It's disability, which is for disability coverage, or die, and that's where life insurance comes into play. You don't want to leave your family in a financial bind in either of those scenarios. And 4, eat less crap. Most people's metabolism retire at 30. To put this into context, allow me to quote Adam Sandler from the film Big Daddy when he said, "When I was your age, I could eat anything I wanted and I wouldn't gain an ounce. Now I have a chocolate shake and my ass jiggles for a week." This may not seem financial related, but if you have a healthy eating and fitness routine and habits in your 30s, you may have less medical expenses as you age. You got to plan ahead. The next question, what are your thoughts on do-it-yourself investors? Can anyone actually invest themselves? On the other hand, do you think everyone should be able to invest themselves? So I think there are certain people in the world who have a do-it-yourself mentality. Some have the time and interest in learning how to do something that are outside their scope of expertise. Most people don't. I'm an outsource anything I am not good at, which is most things type of person. Most people will be well served if they didn't potka around and let a professional handle their things. However, there's room for both types of people in personal finance. I think it's important for folks to be honest with themselves and how much time and ongoing effort they're going to dedicate to properly learning about investing and financial planning. If the answer is very little or never, then you'd be best served if you hired someone to help you. The outsourced approach is far from sensible for most people. Next question, why isn't SPY sufficient? It goes up 13%+ annually. It pretty much solves all my financial planning needs. I feel like I have a variation of this question every week, so allow me to be succinct. First, SPY is the S&P 500 ETF. If your sole goal in life is to track this index, then it is sufficient. If you have other goals, then it is insufficient. 2, SPY does not go up 13%+ annually. 3, SPY is not financial planning. What all investors need is a process and a game plan. A product is not a strategy and is unlikely to solve all your problems. And while I'm mentioning how SPY won't solve all your problems, neither will whole life insurance. This is not relevant to your question, but the common denominator here is that it is also overrated and oversold. Most people should buy term and invest the difference. Okay, next question. I'm a rabbi. I have a rabbi trust provision as part of my contract with my shul. Should I still save in a retirement account? Firstly, for those who don't know, A rabbi trust is typically used by a company or organization to provide executives with additional benefits to their existing compensation package. A rabbi trust creates security for employees because the assets within the trust are outside the control of the employer, meaning they're typically set up to be irrevocable. So once the employer makes contributions to a rabbi trust, they cannot retrieve them. However, a big drawback of a rabbi trust is that they don't protect against creditors. By the way, it's called a rabbi trust because the first of these arrangements to be set up was done by synagogue for their rabbi. So the answer to your question is yes, I would also have a retirement account in addition to this rabbi trust. You want something that creditors of a third party can't go after. This can be in a separate retirement account, of which there are many options depending on your circumstances, or in a regular taxable account. There's no tax benefit to the latter, but the funds are yours and can help support your life once you retire. The bottom line in life is that you can't depend on anyone but yourself. Always have a backup plan in case your shul gets into trouble or screws you over. Okay, that's it for financial questions this week. Again, feel free to email me with any questions you have, and I might answer them in a future episode. You could reach me at jonathan@parkbridgewealth.com. Additionally, if you could take a minute to subscribe to this podcast and rate the show on Apple or Spotify, it will help other personal finance enthusiasts find the show as well. And with that, it's a wrap for this week's show. Any comments or questions, feel free to reach out directly to me via email. I love hearing from my listeners. And finally, the secret to financial success is no secret at all. It's to spend less than you make, invest the difference prudently, and ignore all the noise. See you next time on Jonathan on Money. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. I hope you were able to take away a nugget or two to apply to your own life. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast so you can be alerted whenever new episodes drop. If you'd like to submit a question that may be answered in a future show, please email me at jonathan@parkbridgewealth.com. Be sure to check out all Jonathan on Money content, including all of my articles, webinars, and videos by following me at Jonathan on Money on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Finally, if you like what you heard today, please rate the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This helps ensure that other personal finance enthusiasts can find the show as well. Thank you, and catch you on the next episode of Jonathan on Money.